Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Welcome back to another edition of Zero Block 30. Today, we have three rounds in the magazine. Round number one, we're going to talk about the Wagner coup and what was going on in Russia. Not a lot, because it's a couple days old story, but we're going to give our thoughts and my embarrassment about what happened there. Round number two, we're going to talk about RFK and while he's challenging Joe Biden for the Democratic nomination for president of the United States. Things have been getting out of control with RFK, and people really like him. Like, I see people our age and younger on social media, and they're like, this guy's got it going on, and he's a huge conspiracy theorist. I don't understand it in the slightest.
I'll tell you why. It's abs. If you are good-looking, you can get away with so much more. I always think if I just had a little bit more oomph to me, I could really go off. But
now, what are we talking oomph? You want app? Like, you think Katie Abs is getting it done?
I'll tell you, earmuffs, chaps. Okay. My boobs are like two old beaver tails. Just flat. Put me in R long boobs on Reddit. Something
like
happened to them.
Like unrolled fruit by the foot?
Again, yeah, they're just not, you know, and so if maybe they were up, and I got those Cameron Diaz titties that are, they're like two chameleon eyes looking the other, they're like, I don't know what's going on. Something happened to them.
Old
they're
school
not,
rigs?
Yeah, they're the old school rigs eyes. They're just, one of them's always looking over here. Something happened where if maybe I was a little perkier, a little more upbeat there, I could say some crazier shit and not take heat for it. Maybe a little bit of, I'm getting the turkey gobble. I'm just saying, I have the hooded eyes. If I got a facelift and new breasts, I'd probably be spouting off more tinfoil hat, Katie, on here with more confidence is all I'm saying. And people would like me more.
Your stories today are just totally depressing. Kate's going through, like just going through it. I feel bad for Kate. But I totally agree with RFK. 69 years old. People are acting like he's not on HGH. That dude's on HGH. You don't look like that at almost 70 without being on something.
We'll get into it when we get into the round, but
yeah. All right. So let's get going. Round number one, the Wagner story. So if you haven't been paying attention at all, Wagner is this group that's essentially like the Russian version of Blackwater, but much more intense, much more like Nazi-ish. Essentially, they have committed atrocities all over the world, in places like Syria, in places like Iran, in places like Iraq, in places like the Central Republic of Africa. They're going around the world being mercenaries, getting paid by these governments, and coming in and essentially just messing things up and causing some chaos. Well, they got really upset with what's going on with Russia because they said that they weren't getting armed enough, that they didn't have the artillery that they needed, the bullets that they needed, the guns that they needed. They're running out. So finally, the guy that's in charge of Wagner Group was like, enough is enough. We're going to actually turn and go to Russia. Now, they spent a couple days going to Russia, gained 300 kilometers, which is a lot whenever you're trying to pick up. They're on their way to Moscow and reckon like there was all kinds of Russian military people that were surrendering as soon as they came in. There was people that were Russian troops that joined Wagner so that they can march on Moscow because they were tired of seeing their people killed. The Wagner leader took over Russian television, and they were making all kinds of statements about what's going on and saying that it's your sons and daughters, not the elite, that are dying. If this was a big time war and very important, then it would be the elites that are going as well. But they're just taking conscription people that are from a long ways away. So he had all that going on, goes into Russia. Even Putin was reportedly fled Moscow and went to St. Petersburg so that he could be safe. Crazy news. Crazy.
There was too, the president, everyone was tracking the president of, or the head of Belarus, mm-hmm. like flew over Russia, but turned off his thing and then went to Turkey. And everyone's like, even he's fleeing, like all these guys are fleeing. Wagner and this group is going to take over. But like basically on social media over the weekend, all these experts were like, last week they were submarine experts. This week they were Russia experts. And they were like, this is it. This is the coup that's going to take down Russia. And everyone was praising the leader of the Wagner, like all these people on this side over here. We're praising this leader of the Wagner Group, Prigozhin. Am I saying his name right?
That's why I didn't Prigozhin. Say their names. I have no idea how to say their names.
Are you looking for relief, relaxation, or to party on the motherfucking moon? then check out 3Chi's new True Strains lineup of cannabis vapes and gummies tailored for specific effects. And the best part? It's delivered straight to your door. Visit 3Chi.com. That's 3CHI.com. And for a limited time, get 20% off with the code Barstool20.
But he's also an awful guy versus an awful guy. And they were beefing. But he the founder of the Wagner Group, this Prigazine guy, I'm just going to call him Prig.
Yeah,
he's total prig.
Yeah.
He spoke out today. He said Wagner will cease existence on July 1st. The aim of the march was to avoid the destruction of his group. And he didn't march to overthrow Russia's leadership. He basically said it was because I guess something happened where 20 of the Wagner troops were killed by Russian troops, which was like the last straw of all the disrespect he felt. And if you followed it loosely at all, they've been beefing with each other for a long time anyway, like the main military and this mercenary group. So he was like, we were just coming there to protest. We weren't coming to like overthrow or anything. We were just goofing.
Which is just absolutely trash. Like they're killing people on the way. They're going, it's not so they can get rid of on July 1st. If that's it, just roll it in. I think that dude got paid. I think what happened is like the elites did be like, they're coming and we could get really screwed here. Let's throw some money at the problem. That's the only, I mean, if you're on your way to have this coup and the Western world is watching. So whenever something like this happens, we don't know the ins and outs of what's going on with Wagner or Russia. So if you're here for that, you could just go ahead and just step out.
Undoubtedly, it was a huge embarrassment and a huge setback for Russia as how they're seen on the world stage, which already isn't great. Mm-hmm. And Putin spoke out and was like, as they were on the way, he was like, come on up. We'll fucking, you're all gonna like, we'll kill you all. We don't care. So it was
but
just
the
a
thing
big
about
sloppy mess
with Russia that they give him blanket pardons essentially before trials to all these people that were doing it. That and to the leader just made him go to Belarus. It makes me think that something they paid a lot of money in some way or gave them a lot of something, especially if they're getting rid of it so soon after. I mean, we're talking 4 days. You're going to disband an entire group that's been doing stuff all over the world in 4 days?
Well, people were wondering, too, because this Wagner group, they also control like mines and stuff in Africa and all sorts of military shit, like you said, like in countries around the world. So what's going to happen there? And is this going to create new fractions with new leaders and create more trouble? I don't know. So I've been following
So when something like this happens, I'm sure you do too, Kate, but we get tagged like, hey, explain this to me like I'm five. And I can't, like in the moment, reality is I can't do it because I'm going to sound like an idiot at some point because I'm going to get things wrong because I'm relying on like media sources and all that stuff. So I feel bad after a while when I get so many of those responses. I want to put it in as much context as I possibly can for those that do trust our voices. So I went on, I researched it, spent a lot of time on it, wrote this long blog explaining what the Wagner Group was, explaining the history behind the two different forces. And I kid you not, I pushed publish. 3 minutes after I pushed publish, it was the AP that had announced that there was a truce deal that the leader of Wagner was going to go. So I put up a picture on our Instagram account that was just a screenshot of my tweet with a link to the article. Well, right when it happens, 3 minutes goes by. And of course, everyone's like, how could you possibly think this? You're an idiot. Like of all the different comments that we got, every single one was calling me dumb. And I'm like, I didn't want to write this thing anyways because of something like this. So then I wrote a blog that's like only idiots thought that Wagner was actually going to take charge. And people thought I was serious about that. Like, just look at two back to back. And you just have to sit there and take it all day. And like our community of veterans and military, like, this guy's an idiot. And I was. I deserved it. Totally.
At least I think the thing that makes you not an idiot is your willingness to admit. At least everyone else out there is acting like an expert. And we're like, don't listen to us.
We have no idea.
You go do your own research, pal.
I mean, we can get very superficial information, but they expect us. We're not journalists. Like, we just talk about stuff and we don't know. So that's basically what it boils down to. Wagner's bad. Russia's bad. If they join forces, that's bad. If Russia won, that's bad. And if Wagner won, that's bad. All across the world, what's ever going on in and around Russia, except for the people of Ukraine, bad.
And by the way, people are like, well, Wagner Group is going to, the leader's like, we're disbanding now on July 1st. Well, the leader of Belarus is like, we'll help you guys keep on going anyway. So now it's like they may still be a thing anyway. So who knows? Whatever. Yeah.
I also think that a big part of it is that they heard the Chechens were coming, like that that Russia had called in on the Chechens. And I've told you before, when Chechen gets involved, when those folks get involved, it's going to get ugly. Because they're insane.
Yeah. Everyone's like, just insane. No, thanks. Yeah.
Speaking of insane, let's move on to round number two and talk a little bit about RFK Jr. So he, if you haven't heard, he is trying to become the Democratic nominee.
And can we time out?
Yeah.
Who is he?
He is.
Is he like whose kid?
He's the son of Robert Kennedy Jr. So he
so
is,
that was JFK's brother.
JFK's
so he's
brother.
The nephew of this guy is the nephew of JFK.
Right. And he you could tell he does have the Kennedy appeal because he's 69 years old and he has a full head of hair. He's jacked because of HGH. He got a lot more attention when he recently went on Joe Rogan's podcast and they talked a lot about vaccines and they talked about how vaccines are causing kids to be transgender, how it's causing autism, and major scientific studies from across the world have all debunked that. Like the autism thing's been debunked for like 25 years or something like that, and continuously tested and continuously comes up as no. So the whole thing is crazy. What's going 20%, 20% of Democratic voters said that they were considering RFK over Biden, which surprised me. Like, I think that there's plenty of people that you could pick over Biden that would be good, but 20%.
But I think Biden's camp somehow is underestimating how much people don't want an extremely elderly man in charge of the country.
Right. And he's but RFK is 70. He'll be 74 when it's over, but he's jacked.
But he's jacked. Okay. And I'll say this. Once you're over 65, buddy, go off on the steroids. I don't care what you do.
Oh, yeah.
I don't care what you do.
No.
Start doing cocaine.
Right.
I don't care.
I mean, if you're 68 or if you're 73 and you're not doing black tar heroin, you're messed up.
You're in the final season of life. Enjoy it.
So he's going on all these different tangents about all the different conspiracy theories. So we put together some. This is only some because this guy's been going at it for a while. I read since 2005 is when he got on the anti-vax train. So we're going to go through some of them. And I want you, Kate, if you could believe fact or cap. We're going to use an old kid's term, a youngin's term, fact or capped.
Okay.
All right. What's the first one?
That mass so these are things that RFK believes. Mass shootings are linked to prescription drugs. Kennedy Jr. blamed school shootings on drugs like Prozac in a Twitter discussion, telling Elon Musk, prior to the introduction of Prozac, we had almost none of these events. And then worth noting, there's no scientifically established correlation between psychiatric drugs and mass violence, according to even keel experts across the board. I'm going to say that's fact.
Oh, you think that's fact? Yeah.
I think that, I'm saying there's no correlation between the two.
All right.
Yeah.
So he's wrong. I was like, wow. Yeah. I didn't know Kate would think that. No. I think the correlation is that's about the time where the assault weapons ban ended.
Right. So yes. That would be the closer correlation. The next one, the 2004 presidential election was stolen. He believes that Kennedy Jr. said in a 2006 Rolling Stone article, he was convinced that voter fraud in 2004 allowed George W. Bush to win over John Kerry, while a 2005 postmortem by the Democratic Party found a breakdown of the election system in Ohio. It found no evidence of voter fraud. So I'm going to say also, George W. did not steal the election. He won that fair and square.
Was involved in two then because the Al Gore one, when the pregnant Chads. Yeah.
But I'm going to say no, George W. won that fair and square. Another, he believes the CIA was involved in the assassination of former President John F. Kennedy. I don't even have to read this. I say true.
Yeah, I say true absolutely. Too. If anybody's going to know, it's the nephew. So far, we're 1 for 3. That's pretty good. I mean,
yeah.
That's a good batting average. 333 is a great batting average in pro baseball. So,
And he believes the wrong person may have been convicted in the killing of his father. He cast doubt on the conviction of Saran Saran, not to be confused with Duran Duran.
Mm-hmm.
In 1968, the 68 assassination of his own father, former U.S. Attorney General and Democratic presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy, obviously, as we know, was gunned down by Saran Saran, who confessed days later, though his lawyers have claimed in recent years that he was hypnotized and coerced to kill Kennedy. And
see,
so he's Kennedy
Jr. believes
this. When you go
the first three, right? You go through the first three sentences and you're like, oh, I think it's right. Somebody brings up hypnotized. I lean to believe him, right?
Like, yeah, because that's
and
not
it's
happening
his own dad.
A lot. It's his own dad. And so if he, I can't claim for that. I'll say his fact. I'll believe him there.
And
okay?
If your dad did get assassinated by somebody who was hypnotized by the CIA, I think I'm going full-blown conspiracy theory, too. Being a
also,
conspiracy theory sounds fun as hell.
If you're a CIA hypnotist, we'd love to have you on the show.
Yeah.
You can tell me to do anything. Probably if you hypnotize me, I'll do it. Gun ownership in Switzerland is similar to the United States. While vowing not to take away anyone's guns if elected president, Kennedy Jr. made the debunked claim, despite data that shows U.S. civilians possess an average of 120.5 firearms per 100 people, the highest per capita, compared to 27.6 in Switzerland. So I guess that's false. But
yeah,
he's
so
like, look at Switzerland. Yeah,
that was not actually true. So, but also, if you are a conspiracy theory person, like vaccines, for example, if you don't believe in vaccines, what does it matter what any of these the data says? Like, if you have the people that are saying it's 125 to 100, 27.5 to 100, if you don't believe governmental information or polling or things like that, you can't be reasoned with. You just can't.
Yeah. No, certainly not. And then the COVID-19 virus was genetically engineered. COVID was clearly a bioweapons problem, he said in a Twitter Spaces, repeating a claim promoted by some lawmakers. U.S. intel agencies have said it's possible the virus originated from a lab accident, but have found no evidence to support that it was deliberately leaked. The only reason I can't imagine China doing that to themselves.
But
like
Lyme
but
disease,
I also
we talk about that, right?
What?
The
Lyme disease?
Yeah. What happened in New York?
Yep, that leaked out too. So I can see it being an accident, like definitely a fuck up where it wasn't from some fish market, but it was from an actual like
bat
Chinese.
Soup. Yeah.
But I don't know if it was deliberate because I feel like it's caused so much headache for China too. And like all kinds of weird shit they did in response to that. I don't know.
I don't think it was on purpose either, but I could definitely see that it's man-made and I could see it being a leak.
Yeah.
No doubt.
And again, China's squirrely, man. So I don't know, you know, I could put my
tinfoil
hat on.
And they've been complaining, but isn't their population in decline? I think that's one of the countries that has population in decline, and India has it up, and soon India is going to be the most populous country on earth.
Well, tinfoil, I also heard people saying, like, I'm like, well, why would China do it to themselves? This has really helped them take more control of their people, too. So it's like, I don't know, man. I'm Team RFK. I saw the abs.
Okay,
he's hot
yeah.
enough that I'm going to put it on. Let's see what else here. Former White House medical advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci and Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates sought to exaggerate the pandemic to promote vaccines. So they're saying this the whole COVID thing was a boon for Gates and Fauci because it was all a big PR campaign for them for vaccines.
Yeah, that went real well. Like, people love Fauci. Like, he's the number one beloved guy in the country. If he did that for people to give him accolades, he miscalculated much more than Bud Light.
Yeah, people don't like that guy. And then Kennedy then promoted ivermectin and like those horse pills and stuff for people. Not great. I'm going to say that's not true. I don't think. Vaccines can cause autism. For years, RFK has promoted the theory that the preservative, the thimerosal,
yeah,
which is,
I think you name it, you
which
nailed
it. Has mostly been phased out of modern vaccine formulas anyway, appears to be responsible for the rise in autism, and that the government knowingly allowed the pharmaceutical industry to give a whole generation of children autism. He wrote this in Rolling Stone and Salon in 2006. Despite endless doctors and World Health Organization, the Centers for Disease Control, blah, 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 all being like, There is no credible link at all. You can look at the research right here. There's no link between vaccines and autism at all. Also, I implore you, because I've seen some of my own old buddies on Facebook giving into the no vaccines thing. Go look at pictures of little kids who were not vaccinated and get these diseases.
Mm-hmm. Like measles, mumps is awful. Awful.
Dude, smallpox. I'm telling you, the alternative of no vaccines is just absolutely, truly a horrendous thing. Go look at the pictures of kids affected by that stuff.
Or the life expectancy.
Or the life expectancy.
That's a big
or
one.
The kids who die because they're, these like they don't have their vaccines because this is like a popular thing. I don't know. That's
my grandfather was like that. My grandfather had polio whenever he was a young kid, and it started to go at like his legs. His entire life, he still never recovered fully, where he walked with a very heavy limp. And if that vaccine didn't come out whenever it did, he probably would have had to go to an iron lung because how bad polio was. Like it. So whenever he hears about people not liking vaccines, or he gets like infuriated. Like so many of their friends from that era hate not being able to be vaccinated and needed it because of the polio epidemic.
Yeah, but vaccines, real good
they're
thing.
Pretty
Let's
good.
Keep that going. They're pretty good. Also, too, you know what it is? I was talking about being hot. Wasn't it Jenna Jameson was a big anti-vaxxer?
Yeah, big
time. It's because she was hot enough. Do you see?
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If only.
You are right. You can get away with a lot of stuff if you're hot.
If you're hot. But anyway, RFK was mostly making headlines over the weekend because he was shirtless at Venice Beach working out. And he's
people are going off on him, though, in some of these Instagram posts, Kate. They're saying that he's got fake muscles because in that video when he's doing the incline bench, I don't know if Nick saw it, but he was doing repping like 115, and that's not impressive. And he looked like he was struggling after like 6 to 8 reps.
I think he was maybe at the end of his – he could have been at the end of his set, though.
A superset,
A lot of time, because you'll lift your heavy, and then you'll usually do a burn at the end. Like, I do the same thing, where, like, you rep until failure on something you can not injure yourself on.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Well, obviously, Captain Cons is not here today. He had a super crazy busy day. But he sent me his bullet point notes on RFK and the workout. He had some thoughts. Cons said, the juxtaposition of RFK being anti-vax yet clearly good with pumping his body full of HGH or TRT is wildly comedic. Great point. RFK looks like the AI-generated politicians from those memes. Like when people are like,
like the Barbie memes?
Yeah. Good for him for being 69 and committed to looking jacked. I feel like I support that level of discipline. Mm-hmm. But I said this too. Like, he's like my parents' age. I don't want my dad looking like that. I like my dad.
Yeah, but what if it's not your dad and it's a daddy?
I don't like that. I don't like that sentence either.
Yeah,
I don't
that
like
was not
that
a good sentence at all.
I'd rather our politicians look tan and jacked than old and decrepit like Sleepy Joe. And I think he's got a point here. Like, Joe Biden just fell off that stage. Everyone sees him falling off the bike. He's like,
he's doing what 80-year-olds should do.
He's doing what 80-year-olds are meant to do. I get it. But people want an alternative. And if there's an alternative in the party that's got a six-pack, buddy, we're all checking it out a little bit.
True.
Also, where does he fall on the Kennedy scale of issues? Because that family's got a lot of... I would like to be at the Thanksgiving table just as a fly on the wall. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Got a lot of weird stuff. I could see it being like the Wedding Crashers type family, you know?
Mm-hmm. The Kennedys would be a great family to be involved in. But Kate, you're saying that about
except
dudes.
For all the dying.
They're jacked, if the dudes are all jacked, what if we have a woman candidate that comes out and she's going against Joe Biden and she just dumps him out?
In part, I think people mentioned, I think like the wackadoos a little bit, like Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think they're allowed to do in part because they're like Florida capital.
No, I've been on the Democratic side. Like, you're going against Biden and you dump him out.
I'm just saying, any politician, if you're a hottie boomalati, you've got probably a little bit of an edge, man or woman. I'm just saying, you got a good haircut. You're like deceptively hot at first glance. You're going to go far in D.C. because there's a lot of gargoyles sitting on those, sitting in those seats. And I'd love to turn on C-SPAN and be horny for a change.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
You know, mm-hmm. So a lot of doom and gloom. At least give me something to look at while you're all yelling at each other, for the love of God.
No, I don't think you could dump them out at like the podium. But if you're running, and either way, no matter what gender you are, if you came out and you had an amazing sex tape get leaked, I think the world would be more in fear of the United States if they knew that we had a president that could fuck. Like, when's the last time that you looked at the president of the United States and were like, this person can absolutely get down between the sheets? Carter?
I'll tell you what, Clinton was horny, but I don't think he cared about pleasing women.
No, yeah. True.
I think George W. was actually a very generous lover, probably.
He's in very good shape.
Yes. And he's an artist, and artsy people tend to know where the clitoris is.
Mm-hmm. And Obama was a big stickler for details.
So, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to something completely different. Let's talk about some war crimes. So last year, or I don't even think it was last year, a couple years ago, President Trump had pardoned Clint Lawrence, and there was all kinds of hullabaloo about it. You had one side of the veteran community, and not really one side, I would say 10% of the veteran community, who really rallied around Clint because war, I guess. I don't know like what the reason was. And then 90% were like, no, this is straight up war crimes.
I'd say it's the same polarization of like Eddie Gallagher.
Yes, very
Clint
Lawrence much the
falls
same.
Into that category.
And it was all at the same time, too.
Who is the politician we had on who was like, yeah, I did war crimes. What of it?
Oh, everybody's Duncan like, Hunter.
Duncan Hunter. Like, there's this very small group. Yes. Okay. Carry on.
So there's a lot of news about Clint going to, I think he graduated from law school, and now he's trying to go get past the bar. And so that's why our guest Todd came on. I saw a tweet thread about it, and I wanted to make sure that I got his thoughts on what was going on, because he was one of the only less than 10 people that were there that witnessed it, that saw it from the beginning. And I didn't know this. I did know it, but I forgot because it's so shocking. All those different things happened, and he was only in charge for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So the first day they released, no, I'm not going to tell it. Let's let Todd tell it. Here it is.
Barstool Sports and Foreplay have partnered up with Skillz, the leading sports skill training brand, to develop co-branded golf training aids that will help you improve your game. The Skillz Barstool Golf line was designed to help sharpen every aspect of your game from tee to green. The products help you develop your swing, whether it's gaining distance, improving accuracy, chipping around the greens, or dialing in your putting. All products are made by golfers for golfers. They were developed by industry experts who understand the game. Skillz Barstool Golf products are now available at golfgalaxy.com/barstool or in store at Golf Galaxy and select Dick's Sporting Goods House of Sport locations.
Now on Zero Blog 30, I'm privileged to have Todd Fitzgerald, or as the fellas called him, Fitzy. And the reason why we're having him on is because there's some news that came out about Clint Lawrence. And if you don't remember who Clint Lawrence is, he's the piece of shit who got pardoned by President Trump. He was convicted of war crimes for attempted murder, all kinds of shit, and then got out. And a lot of people that were in the unit, like Todd was at the time, were pissed, and rightfully so. So, Todd, can you walk us through what happened with Clint Lawrence when you were around?
Yeah, so we had been in Afghanistan since February of 2012. We were in the Kandahar district, and we'd originally started in a province called Maywan. After 5 or 6 weeks, we shifted over to Zari, which is some agricultural land, and we stayed there. In the middle of June, we were hit by an implanted IED. We walked over an IED. It injured Mark Kerner, a private who was a very good friend of mine, and our lieutenant, a platoon leader, Lieutenant Dominic Latino, who both had to be medevaced. And for about a week and a half there, we didn't have a platoon leader. We're kind of in the wind. It was a very, very tight time in Afghanistan for a lot of the forces, I'm sure. So they eventually sent us a replacement. His name was, you know, as we all know now, it's Clint Lawrence. I had never met him. I'd never heard of him. It was just, he was new to us. He had been enlisted. He was the same age as me. He'd been enlisted. I had joined at 25, but he'd been enlisted for about 10 years, I believe, as an MP, and came into us as sort of green and as an infantry officer. You know, and so he introduced himself to all of us. And on the very first day, a farmer came up with his child to our front gate to ask if he could move the concertina wire to get across the street. And Clint Lawrence threatened his life. He threatened his child's life. He became very, not just threatening, but sort of aggressive. And it was kind of a shock to all of us. I know that, you know, it was something we discussed. We kind of reported up to our NCO support chain, and, you know, we just let them deal with it.
And how many people were there and saw that interaction?
Yeah. You know, I don't even recall how many. I know the gate guards, you know, the sergeant on guard.
Less than 10 or more than 10?
Probably less than 10. You know, I mean, overall, we were at a platoon size strong point. So there was only, you know, 30 to 35 of us maybe total.
Okay.
Spread out between doing route security, constant route security, constant guard towers, and having to do missions. So, okay. You know, we had a very tight rotation. We didn't have a man to spare, but it was definitely, it was seen by a lot, you know, a lot of us, you know, a good number of us. And it was talked about. And that was like the, you know, day one, that's right off the bat. And I do recall actually saying something. I turned to one of the Joes in the tent. I don't remember who it was, honestly, off the top of my head. And I remember telling him, I was like, you know, the only way this ends is in a 15-6, which, you know, for non-military personnel is the army, destination for a criminal investigation. And it was just a bad feeling I had in my gut. And I wish I'd been wrong about it, but.
And what rank were you at the time?
I was a specialist. I'd been in the army for a little over 2 years. And so, you know, the next day, I was still back on post, and, one of the, there was some outgoing fire from one of the guard towers. I was in the tent. I came out of the tent with a couple other soldiers to sort of see, you know, check out what was going on, and we could hear fire from the guard tower, you know outgoing. We didn't hear any incoming fire prior to or following. I witnessed Lieutenant Lawrence come out of the guard tower and have a conversation with Sergeant Daniel Williams. Sergeant Williams got very aggravated. It's my understanding from what I overheard and what I've read since that Clint Lawrence had asked Sergeant Will to call up a report saying that we had taken fire and that we'd returned fire, which was very obviously false. Sergeant Will refused to do that, you know, because there was no basis for it. We weren't in the habit. We weren't ever, it wasn't, you know, it's illegal to call up a false report.
Yeah.
So we said no, you know, Sergeant Will said no. You know, I know that the guard in the tower had eventually refused to continue to fire. He had fired a few shots. I know he hit a motorcycle, scared some men, and then he refused to continue shooting as was directed by the lieutenant.
And at that point in your career, had you ever seen an NCO or enlisted person straight up tell an officer, no, I'm not going to do that?
No,
you know, it's fucking crazy
you're
to even
your
think
whole
about
career
it.
When you say no, that's, you know, if an officer tells you something, you know, generally speaking, it's a legal order.
Right.
Unless you can explicitly recognize it as unlawful, then you have an obligation to refuse, which, you know, obviously I, you know, I'll get to that. But, you know, so day one, you know, he threatens a farmer and his child, and is very aggressive, very, you know, frightening to them and frightening to us, because, you know, we're like, oh, you know, we don't do that. We have a reputation with the folk. We had built up a rapport with them. The townsfolk, the locals, we went in there all the time. You know, we had shuras with them weekly meetings, that we consider them friends and allies. And I'm sure they thought the same of us, because they would speak to us and they would give us information, tell us what they'd been seeing and stuff. But, you know, it was already, you know, 2 days in a row and just two just it was bad all around. And then on the third day, I was up for patrol that day. And before our patrol stepped off, a motorcycle came up to our entry control point, the front of our base, with three men on it. One of them was the village elder. And the other two, if I'm not mistaken, were his brother and son, or his brothers, you know, they're the three of them. They came up, you know, they got off, they started to talk to us through the interpreter. And they wanted to know why their village, technically it was two villages. If there was a road leaving our strong point, and then if you went down the road, you know, a ways, there's an intersecting road. And if you turned right, there was one small little compound of housing area. And if you went left, there was the other village. And those are really kind of the two, you know, you and I might not recognize it as, you know, we might just be like, oh, this is just one village because it was so small, but right. You know, it was, so they'd come up and they were like, you know, why were you shooting into the village the other day or yesterday? They, you know, just very inquisitive.
As one would be.
Yeah. You know, when they had a bike that had been damaged, they wanted compensation for it, you know, because they needed it. It was their transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And Clint, you know, he wasn't hearing it. He didn't want to listen to him. He didn't want to talk to him. He told him to come back to the Shura, come back on Friday to where we would have our weekly Shura, and then charged his weapon. He racked the slide of his M4 to load around and put it right in their faces and said, you know, I'm going to count down. And he started counting down, you know, the way that you, you know, with the child, you know,
right.
Like I'm counting down five. And then at this point, the interpreter is panicking, you know, he's trying to, you know, go back and forth. He doesn't know what's going on. We're telling the guys, hey, listen, you know, we're telling the interpreter, hey, tell them to go back. We'll talk to him. Like, this isn't supposed to be going this way. You know, we're not here to threaten anybody. And they just came up to ask some questions. So we told them to go back. They get on their bike and then they drive back down the road towards their villages. And I know they went into, they turned right into the village that had been shot into, and probably to tell we were assholes. And then we stepped off. And it took, we moved very slowly because we had a mine hound. We were scanning for IEDs. We had to cross the road, just the road that was outside our compound. We had to cross it to get into the grape rows. But as we were crossing the road, they left the village that they had just gone into, and they're driving back down the street into their own village. It's a very important point to make, because for years and years and years, Clint and his defense have been saying that this bike was like speeding towards us. Just to be clear, it wasn't on the same road as us. It was driving, you know, across our field of view into their own village. And Private Skelton, who was with us, he's our company intelligence support member. He had the biometric automated toolkit. He did a lot. He did all of the, you know, fingerprints and retinal scans. He saw the bike with the men. And as is typical on any patrol in Afghanistan, or I imagine any other theater of war, because everybody has different perspectives, if you see something, say something, anything at all, you know, person, vehicle, anything. So he just said,
just being,
you know,
vigilant.
Yeah, just there's motorcycle, three guys. It was a very basic observation, and without any, you know, and to backtrack a little bit, Clint had told us before this patrol that there'd been a change in ROE. He wasn't convicted of this because it's kind of, I think there was some difference in people saying where it came from, but he said we could engage motorcycles on site, which is not something I'd ever heard before. Not something I've heard from anybody else.
Mm-mm.
And so when Skelton saw this motorcycle and said, hey, motorcycle, you know, three men, Clint just told us to fire. I mean, he just immediately told us, you know, shoot him. And I think everybody on the ground was a little bit perplexed by that. Initially, nobody did anything. Skelton did fire two shots. They stopped their bike. They got off. They looked across the grape rows at us, you know, because, you know, they were at this point, they were, you know, down the road and, you know, down, you know, left. So there was just grape rows between us. And they looked at us and they started to kind of walk down the road so they can get closer and speak with us. And the ANA just kind of waved them back, said, no, just, you know, wait there. We'll come to you. It was yelling distance. You know, it wasn't very close. They had to, you know, it was a lot of hands, arm motions. And Clint was still telling us at this point, after they'd stopped their bike, after they'd gotten off, still screaming at us, shoot them, you know, shoot them. Why isn't anybody firing? And I, you know, nobody, at that point, nobody fired. The ANA had not fired any rounds at all. I know that's something that Clint in his defense had claimed had happened. That never happened. Skelton had been, he, like I said, he had only popped off two rounds. And so Clint got on the radio and told the gun truck that was sitting out on the road for route security, and he ordered them to open fire. And I think they were a little confused by the order because they didn't take on the first. And he was on the radio yelling and yelling. And eventually the gunner did release a burst from the 240. And the, you know, the two of the men instantly dropped.
So what was his response? And what was really the platoon's response? Because I was talking to my wife about doing this interview, and I kept coming back to, after I was reading the reports, it's so like, if you haven't been in that position, it's so rare for enlisted people to be like, they cleared us hot, we're not going to do this. And for everybody to come together and be like, this is morally wrong. Like, to go against the person who's put in charge of you, the officer, the commander that's in charge of you, and be like, no, he's the one that's wrong. Because typically it's going to be the other way. The officer draws everybody back, the platoon sergeant pushes everybody forward. And that's kind of how the military works. So when those rounds come off and everybody's looking around, what do you guys all do? Are you just kind of dumbfounded and didn't know what to say?
I would describe it as like a very heavy atmosphere. You know, once they were killed, we began to push up through the grape rows. I know that the gun truck had overwatch on the bike and the bodies. And typically during a patrol, you know, there'd be some idle banter, you know, just chit chat sometimes. But it was very quiet. You know, I don't think anybody knew what to say. And we got closer, and as I mentioned previously, Skelton was our COIST member, our company intelligence support member, and he had the biometric automated toolkit, and it was very typical of him to do the battle damage assessments. Anytime we had access to a deceased individual after an engagement, he would use that to capture their fingerprints and retinal scans and match them in the in the database. And Skelton had asked Clint at that time, you know, do you want me to go check the bodies? And Clint said, no, you're not going to like the results. Which we knew that, but
yeah,
we had to do it. I mean, we had to get that information for posterity. And so instead, Clint sent two other soldiers. I remember one of them was, I feel bad naming guys that really just want to move on with their life. Leon was one of them. I don't recall the second one off the top of my head. He sent two other guys to go over and check the bodies and roll them. And then they came back and reported what they had found. And I know we marched past the bodies when we left the village, and they were still undisturbed. Everything was still there. And at some point, I believe Private Skelton had grabbed up the contents of their pockets, which was a couple cucumbers, some scissors, and an ID card, which is something that notably Talvian is not going to carry with them.
Right.
They're not going to have a local government ID card. They're probably not from the local area if they're coming in to conduct warfare. But one thing that was really striking and really upsetting, I think, was once the bodies have been turned, the pockets have been turned out and they've been checked. They asked, you know, what do you want us to do? They have, you know, they have these IDs on them, or they have ID identification on them. And Clint told us all, he said, just forget that you saw that.
Wow.
And you know, and that's why I think it was Skelton who grabbed the stuff and bagged up the evidence so that when he came back, he could present it to our captain, our company commander. But you know, everybody knew that was wrong. I know that's wrong, you know that's wrong. Mm-hmm. And then after we pushed through the, you know, into the village, he was very I think he felt nervous. I think he wanted to go quickly. He didn't want to linger. And we were all worried too, because after that, you know, we were in a very vulnerable spot at that point. The villagers were upset. There were a lot of women and children came out. There was a crowd of them gathered. They were crying. They're making, you know, wails, you know, it was a terrible, terrible sound to hear. If you've ever seen somebody's family like mourning their death immediately after it happens, you'd understand. And Clint was, he pointed his gun at them and he said, shut the fuck up or I'll kill you too. To these women and these kids, you know, he was very obviously not cool and collected, not calm. We pushed through the village very quickly, and we returned back to our strong point. And it was like, it was still very heavy atmosphere.
So are the soldiers talking to each other when all this is going on? Like, you get back.
I think what happened is once we got back and once we were able to break up from that, you know, the patrol group
away from where he could hear you.
Yeah. Nobody, you know, nobody wants to be the first person in a big group in a large group to be like, this is all fucked up, you know, or to point out the bad thing. You know, nobody wants to be the person to be like, hey, I hate to be the bearer of bad news. You know, it's a saying for a reason. And I think once we got back and we started a process, like, holy shit, like, this just happened. Like, we need to report this. We need to say something. You started seeing these little groups, you know, two, three, four guys forming up and whispering amongst each other and then going to whichever NCOs they felt most comfortable with. And, you know, I think we were all we were all horrified by what had happened. And I remember wanting to go back. I was like, take me up to the top. Take me to the company outpost. I want to talk to open door policy right this fucking minute. I want to talk to the commander and the first sergeant. We all had something to say. And yeah, it was reported right then and there. I mean, I don't know exactly who got there first, who said what first. But I know that as soon as I had the opportunity, I went up there. I voluntarily gave them a sworn statement. And relieved that, you know, he was relieved of his command and we were relieved to you know, have him gone, I guess. Just it was an awful thing. And I wish it had never happened. I wish they had, I don't know, you know, it's.
Yeah, I imagine it's tough, and remembering this and going back through, it's incredibly difficult. So you're out there with your commanding officer right there, your platoon leader, and then you go back and you talk to the company commander and first sergeant. You have a failure of leadership at the small unit leader level, and then you go and talk to the next level up in your chain of command as company commander and first sergeant. What's their response? Do they initially give any indication to the soldiers, or do they kind of take it in without any emotion really, and they're telling you? What was their initial responses?
Well, by the time I got up to see Captain Swanson and everybody, they were very, at that point, they were very somber. They were taking it very seriously. I did hear from Mike, who was our weapons squad leader since then, in the years since then, I've heard that when he first went up and talked to Commander or Captain Swanson, our company commander, Captain Swanson was kind of like, I think for him, it was almost unbelievable. Like, are you fucking serious? Like, are you, like, is that... are you being real right now? But because that's not something you ever expect to hear. Definitely not something any commander would want to hear. But he did he took it very seriously, and he took immediate action to make sure that we were given the space and the time to write our sworn statements. He had CID come, we had CID come up and talk to us individually. You know, it felt like everything worked, you know. A lot of times, if you have an issue in the unit, you can go to your first line, and you can sit around and wait and wait and wait and see if something happens. But it felt like, you know, it was such a egregious offense that they wasted no time. They said, okay, yeah, we need to pull him. We need to call up to the battalion and brigade headquarters, have them come down. Because, you know, it's the middle of the war,
right?
And,
you
know,
guys still have operations. You still have responsibilities.
Yeah,
you still have your
personnel,
AO. You have all that.
Personnel is like either generally it's lifeline or eyesight. You know, I know guys who got concussions and, you know, they were, you know, give them a MACE test, maybe a day off. You know, as long as you can walk and talk and see with both eyes, pull security, you know, you're needed.
Right.
So to pull personnel like that and to have to launch an investigation, it's, you know, I know it must have been a massive undertaking for the company commander, and it must have been a huge decision, but they did, you know, like I said, by the time I got up there to give my sworn statement, they were very serious. They were very Everybody's, it seemed, you know, they were calm about it. I know I had, I've read from Clint's defense that we were all like put in a room and threatened with charges. I never experienced that.
Today's show is also brought to you by More Labs. I don't know about you, but I can't drink as much as I could in college without feeling like garbage. Even just a few drinks has you feeling like crap these days. And in a world where we're being pulled in a thousand different directions, you can't afford to miss a day. More Labs created this nifty lifesaver drink called Morning Recovery that helps prevent rough mornings after drinking. Similar drinks have existed in Korea for a long time, but there were no options for it in the U.S. that worked. So their founder quit his job at Tesla to fix that and create Morning Recovery. It's super simple. All you have to do is drink one Morning Recovery while you drink or before you go to bed. It contains super herbs, vitamins, and minerals that help you bounce back and a proprietary blend of electrolytes to rehydrate you. So you can have fun at night and feel good the next day. Feel like a real human like you did when you were 21 and that young whippersnapper with the incredible immune system, the incredible ability to bounce back. That thing don't stick around for a 40-year-old like me. They conducted a clinical study of users of Morning Recovery felt 80% better than those without the Morning Recovery across various symptoms after drinking. We are talking about being dehydrated, all that kind of stuff. You need to try it out. Go to morelabs.com. That's morelabs.com and use the code ZBT for 20% off your first order of Morning Recovery.
I never felt pressured to do or say anything.
That sounds moronic, right? Like if you're a company commander, one of your lieutenants goes out and unjustly kills people, and then you're going to come in and try to protect that guy and put yourself at risk as well as like a cover up. That just doesn't seem plausible at all to me. And so did they remove him from the FOB initially? What did they do with him? They took
him up to the FOB. So our platoon was at a strong point, and then the second platoon headquarters was up at the company outpost, and then our battalion and brigade were way back at the FOB. Like, I mean, I can't tell you how far out on the line we were. They, from my understanding, they came from the FOB and picked him up that day or soon thereafter. But he was removed from our strong point immediately after we got back and reported it.
So when you were there with after Clint leaves and you guys are there, you still have a mission, you still have to do things that you're supposed to do. It's supposed to leave the back of your mind. Did the company commander first start and bring everybody together and talk about how we understand that this was incredibly wrong, one of the most wrong things that you can do in a war environment, but we have to press forward? How was that mentally on you, and what did you observe from the rest of your platoon?
I think it's a little bit difficult to speak about the experiences I had with the company commander and first sergeant personally, because I actually did get a lot more FaceTime with them than other soldiers. As part of my duties, I spent a little bit of time inside of the tactical operations center on the COP. Working with their unmanned aerial systems. And so he was always very, polite, reassuring. In the rest of the platoon, honestly, they took, I don't know how many guys, 8, 10, 12, they took a chunk of the platoon out. They pulled them away out of the strong point, out of the AO, back to the FOB, I think because of the ongoing investigation. And they had to pull a separate platoon from our brigade and kind of plus us up. So suddenly we're integrated. Half of them are new faces. Half of us had just witnessed this these murders. And the rest of the deployment there, I stayed until September when we ripped out and we were not replaced. It was terrible. It was dangerous. It was it was magnitudes more dangerous than it had been prior to the deaths of Haji Muhammad Aslam and Gama Abdul Haq. Because up until that point, we had, like I said, we built a rapport. They had been speaking with us. We generally felt a lot safer between our strong point and the village. In that area, we had sort of a little buffer zone where we felt like, hey, if they see something, they're going to tell us. So we felt like we had a bit of an edge there. But after the murders. They didn't want to talk to us. They didn't want to share anything with us. The Taliban felt comfortable pushing through the village up close to our strong point. They popped out and would fire RPGs or shoot at us. That had happened. That had not been happening previously. They started to ambush trucks on our road. It was very obviously that led to a direct increase in the hostilities. And so it was a very difficult time. And I know that they, you know, the company commander, the first sergeant did provide us, they tried to give us as much as they could in terms of time to kind of recover and process, and if we needed to talk to somebody. And I think maybe the people they took back may have, I don't know who they pulled back and why. And I think maybe some of that may have been contingent on how the individuals felt. You know, I'm sure if I said, hey, I can't go on, they would have probably sent me back and found a replacement if they absolutely needed to. But, you know, that was, I did feel supported after, you know, after all those events went down. I did feel like we had the support, but it was just like we faced an insurmountable obstacle after that.
And clearly you're still talking about it now. So it's something that's going to be a part of your life going forward, like whether that's publicly in the media, situations like this is your first podcast. So I don't want anybody listening and be like, this guy's going on a tour or anything like that. I came across a tweet thread that you did, and I was like, oh my God, man. So we have all of this stuff going on, and stuff, it might be the lightest way I could possibly put it. You come back and you leave your deployment, and it's not over, clearly. How does the trial go? How does the work up to the trial? What was your mindset like then when you were like, this is about to go down? He needs to go down for this.
So that's a really good question. The court martial didn't happen for an entire year after, which I think it might be, you know, might be normal with UCMJ. I don't know. It's the only experience I've had with UCMJ.
Yeah, for murder, it's pretty on par.
But interestingly enough, I think part of the reason why I'm speaking out today is very much just happenstance. It just happened that I got to the 82nd in early 2010, it was late 2010 actually. It was almost Christmas time, but it was earlier than the rest of my unit. I was the first FNG. And so I had already been there for a couple of years, and I had actually came down on orders to PCS to Fort Campbell while I was still in Afghanistan.
Wow.
You know, my platoon sergeant had told me one day, he's like, hey, Fitz, you got orders to you know, Campbell. And I was like, well, how the hell am I going to Campbell? I got to go home first.
Yeah.
I thought it was funny, but, you know, I came back after deployment. You know, after deployments, generally, it's a much, much lower op tempo in garrison. There's a lot more downtime. You get some early releases. You know, they understand that you need to, soldiers need to unwind. They need to fall back into a training routine and physical fitness routine. But I was gone pretty soon after from our unit. I went to Campbell, and I recall I believe the Army Times called me first. I don't know. They must've Googled my number. They called me up, and I think it was, you know, it was sometime maybe before the, I don't know if it was before or after court martial. They were like the first people ever call me. And I just thought, oh, well, this is a reporter just doing their job. And they asked me some questions. I was like, yeah, I'd love to talk about it. And I didn't feel like anybody was going to say anything to me about it or hear about it or was going to come back. I just figured, you know, this is a pretty typical thing. You know, I imagine, I don't, like I said, again, first experience.
Right.
And they did an article, and it was, you know, there wasn't like much fanfare. And then a few months, and then I know at that point, Clint's family and appellate defense lawyers started this whole grassroots campaign to sort of bring awareness to his imprisonment. However, they had a completely different spin on it. Mm-hmm. And the New York Times was the second media organization to reach out to me. They reached out a few months later, I believe, and I thought, yeah, I'll tell you about it, just like I told Army Times, and I told them what I knew. And I think that there were guys still back in the unit that, you know, some of them just, I think a lot of people just want to live their lives and don't want to be bothered and don't want to be reminded of ugly things in the past. And it's certainly anybody's prerogative. And I think some of the higher ups may have been worried that if they spoke out, there might be, you know, reprisals within the military. Maybe, you know, it would give a black eye to the brigade. You know, you have brigade commanders, you have much higher ups, field officers that have to answer for things that happen under their command as well. And you don't want to, potentially, so maybe for some reason, and this is all me speculating. I don't know. I was a lonely, I was a little specialist. I had left, I got a couple calls and I was like, yeah, I'll talk about it. And I started to see the buildup of his defense, building this fake narrative about what was going on. And I just kept speaking out
A hero scorned.
because nobody was telling me not to, except, I mean, obviously all his supporters were telling me not to, but it wasn't like I never feared any sort of reprisal. I never feared, like, I just thought that the truth should be told. And when I heard, I think Alan West was one of the first big name people I heard talking about it. He was saying this hero is in prison for saving his troops, and he gave up this whole fake story. And I went to his Facebook page, I read it, and I commented. I said, "Hey, no, you've got this all wrong." And I was like, "I was one of the soldiers there, and that's this is kind of what this is what happened." And I shared with him some articles from the Fayetteville Observer. They had sent a local reporter in to sit in on the court martial, and he'd written a few articles. And it's a primary source for all those intrepid, inspiring journalists out there. And I just linked that, and I shared some quotes. And he deleted all of my comments. He blocked me from his page. And the very next day, he re-released the story, but he added a section where he was talking about how the soldiers under Clint flipped on him, which really makes it sound like we didn't want. I mean, he first of all, they didn't mention that we were the ones who turned him in, and then he made it sound like they levied these accusations, these false allegations, saying that we were all threatened with charges, and that we were all pressured to testify. We were all ordered. We were all granted immunity. I can't speak for everybody, but in my experience, none of that happened. And I just wanted to set the record straight. For me, it was just a matter of like, hey, you're talking about me and the people I was with, and this isn't true. And that's when I got silent. They just basically silenced me on their end. They didn't want to hear from me. They didn't want me to reach out. They don't want me telling people this. But and I don't know. I think the rest of the guys kind of, the unit ended up being disbanded. The Fourth Brigade has actually been closed up now for Fort Bragg in the 82nd, and so they were eventually sent off to I don't know where else. Other units. Some of them got out of the military.
Just your basic PCS kind of stuff after it's over, or not over, but I mean, pretty normal. The
Yeah,
army doesn't stop,
and
like
like I
it
said,
keeps going and
it was a
going.
year to the court martial, and the court martial's, it took like a week. Deliberation, I think, was a couple hours. It was all very, to me, it just felt like the wheels were turning at a normal pace. It went fairly short, and I didn't think, I thought, okay, it's over and done with. He got sentenced to 20 years later, revised to 19. And I kind of almost forgot about it until I started seeing, like I said, and started seeing these far right, fake news stories, basically just telling the exact opposite. And I think a lot of the rest of the guys were just, they just wanted to go on with their lives. So it's just, that's a terrible thing to live through for anybody. I can't imagine being a family member of somebody that it was killed unjustly. But I,
It's tough. And then there was a bunch of fanfare after President Trump had pardoned him, and there was all kinds of news that was coming
Yeah,
out
his
about
yeah
it.
they had
Very
so
conflicting.
his appellate lawyers had managed to get onto Fox, and then they started drawing massive amounts of support from these really conservative, this really conservative aging fan base. They were, and I know their nonprofit was, getting millions of dollars yearly donated to them. And it's interesting enough, if you check their tax filings, you'll see who they were paying out to, the lawyers' own for-profit organizations for the work they were doing. So to me, it looks like a giant grift.
Right, yeah.
Smells like a giant grift. Kind of walks like a giant grift.
So he's been out for a while. The story's kind of died down at this point. Like, I haven't heard anything about Clint
Yeah.
in a long time. And then I
Yeah.
came across your tweet thread, and there was a big onus for you to start talking about that again. What was it? Or is it, I should say.
So yeah. So ever since Clint got out, he wrote a book. I'm sure he made up the pod. He made a bunch of podcasts. I follow the news as it pertains to me. And if my name's kept out of it, most of the time I don't care. But I, if it's something I experienced, I witnessed, I do want to set the record straight. I do want to tell the truth. I don't want to be dragged through the mud. I don't, you know, I don't want people lying about my part in it. That's upsetting to me. But more importantly than that, and I think a lot more relevant to the point, was that he did announce his intentions when he got out. He's going to say he's going to go to law school. And I'm aware, you know, my mother was a lawyer. I know a lot of other lawyers. I have friends who are lawyers. I'm aware that there is a portion of that you have to sit for the state bar exam in whichever state you wish to practice. And there's a portion of the exam that's character fitness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had seen this. They had, you know, every month or so I checked to make sure there's no new news. I'd rather there be no news. No news is good news. For both of us, it's easier. I want everybody to go back to living their life. But again, if it pertains to me, if my name gets brought up, I'm going to speak out. And when I saw originally that he had been listed as an applicant for the State Bar of Oklahoma, I thought, there's no way. Like, there's no way that they can pass somebody through, you know, moral fitness and character for all this. And I thought about it for days and days. And I thought back to when his family and his lawyers started getting Fox appearances, and I tried to speak out. I was competent at Fox, and I feel like I didn't do enough. I wish I'd reached out to my local senator, my local congressman. I wish I got them to contact the other congressman. There was like 20 members of Congress that signed on to this pardon, you know, and I wish I had gone through the channels to try to get a hold of them and to try to get, you know, tell them, hey, you need to stop and ask the people who were there what happened, because that's you know, they're going to say they're supporting the troops, but what they're doing is they're signing on to this false narrative that is essentially the only way for them to spin it and say that Clint is a good guy is by saying that we must have wronged him.
Yeah.
And making us bad guys. And the fact that he lied about it just after, not just immediately after murders, he called up a report. He told one of the soldiers to do it, and the soldier refused. But he got on the radio and called up and said the bodies couldn't be searched because they had been taken away. That was very much not true. He did get convicted of, you know, making a false statement and obstruction of justice. And these are, you know, these are the kinds of things that I believe should rightly bar somebody from holding a position of authority, any position that requires judgment.
Because that's a sworn statement. Like when the same thing as filling out an affidavit. Like it's the same thing.
Right, right. And I saw what his lawyers did for him, and I know it was wrong because I was there. And there aren't, you know, it's not like there's a whole lot of people in this world that can speak up about it, because there weren't very many of us there to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that it would be I would be failing my own principles if I sat back and I didn't object on those grounds, because I mean, I fucking know, pardon my language, but who else knows better than somebody who had to witness that?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't want to, if I say nothing, then the only voices that get heard are the ones that are
lying.
They're going to say what they want. That's
right.
You know, that's what I hear that a lot. I hear that from people. Oh, well, people can say what they want. You know, I guess so. If you don't care about, you know, telling the truth or being honest.
I think that goes for like sports teams. I'm not sure if that necessarily applies to war crimes and murder, you know?
Yeah. You know, when you sit in front of a, you know, a jury of your peers, when you that's. So yeah, I don't. I feel like it, him being admitted to a bar would be wrong. I feel like he lacks the ethics and the morals necessary. I don't believe he should be given the opportunity to make those decisions to have a position in which he's going to affect the outcome of people's lives. He was given the responsibility for people's lives once before, and he failed in that spectacularly in a way that nobody ever should. And to this day, he's never admitted any culpability. He's never apologized. He's never taken responsibility for his own actions. He did make a statement after the court martial. He said, "I take responsibilities for the actions of my men."
Wow.
Which is a very distinct thing to say, because it excludes himself.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And you had in your tweet thread, you had a very particular call to action. For our listeners that are listening or watching, what would you like?
So I don't want to overwhelm the Oklahoma State Bar Association. I don't want to interrupt their day-to-day. You know, they are an institute. You know, they are their own institute. I have a lot of respect for the rule of law. I don't want them flooded with a million letters and phone calls. But if anybody in Oklahoma knows a licensed attorney who is comfortable researching, who is comfortable looking up the original, the original news reports from inside of the courtroom, those are the people who are Oklahoma State Bar members, licensed attorneys. Those are the people who those are his peers. Those are the people who have that power to write into the bar and to make, to give that feedback to allow them to consider their applicants. So I appreciate everybody sharing it. Like I said, I just don't want, you know, I know a lot of people want to write. I'm only writing him because I'm going to write him
firsthand. Yeah.
Because I, as an eyewitness, I feel like I have just absolutely relevant information, you know, pertaining to directly to his moral fitness and character. I don't want just every single other person to, you know, like I said, overwhelm them. They have jobs, just keep the awareness, you know. I think every but one of us has a responsibility. When we're online and we're seeing these stories, we do need to think about what we're sharing and if it's, you know, how does it, are we a part of it? Do we know everything? I think we've all at some point in our life clicked a link and shared it and later found out it's not exactly what we thought it was. Maybe the story was different. I wish for everybody to just get involved in your local politics, you know, show up to vote, show up to figure out what issues are actually affecting either you, or if there aren't any laws being passed right now today that pertain directly to you, then consider your privilege and find out who's being affected by the laws that are being written, by legislation that is being passed, and the decisions that are being made by the people that you know, volunteer to continue this democracy. And be involved and be, like I said, knowledgeable. Do research, you know, keep your mind open to critical thinking, ask questions, try to get multiple viewpoints, and always try to maintain a sense of a little sense of objectivism. And that's very hard for me to say in this situation, I can't, you know, I'm a biased source, I know, but, yeah, I appreciate that. I didn't expect that tweet thread to go viral, and I really hope I didn't, you know, cause any undue trouble for the State Bar of Oklahoma. But I would recommend anybody to just stay aware. Just share your knowledge. You know, if you find something out, if you learn something, you know, share it, especially with your neighbors, people who live around you. Like I said, figure out what's going on in your little part of the world.
And I think that's great advice, Todd. I appreciate your courage doing this, because it's not an easy subject to talk about, especially when a lot of times situations like this can cause so much vitriol online and getting attacked and all those kind of things. So I appreciate your bravery and I appreciate you coming on today. All right, let's move on to some save rounds and alibis. Catherine, we'll start with you and all your home buying drama. For those that haven't heard, what is going on with Katie Chicago?
It's not necessarily home buying drama. It's just the more I look at it, because I still haven't been in it yet. I won't until the day I move in.
Oh, you haven't even done a tour?
No, dude. I've done a FaceTime tour. I've never stepped foot in this home.
Wow. I didn't know that. I thought you saw it whenever you were in Chicago.
Nope. All the houses I've been on in Chicago when I was there, cash buyers swooped in and whatever. So yeah, no, this was like a, I don't know. I'm sure it's going to be wonderful. Mm-hmm. But it's smaller than I thought. And I just got it appraised. I decided to get it appraised. And it got appraised at a little above what I'm paying for it. So that's good.
Nice.
But in the photos, I started looking and I'm like, that's not a regular size refrigerator. That's not a regular size washer and dryer, is it? That garage, can it fit a car? So I think it's maybe a little tiny, but that's okay.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
That's okay. We'll make
how many square feet did you know square footage or anything?
Yeah, so there was two different square footages.
Oh.
And I already knew it was similar. So I tried to go room by room and do the math. And you mm-hmm. know me with math.
Yeah, great at it.
Well, it turns out I was off by well over 1,000 square feet.
Oh, when that's pretty significant.
When the old Scooby-Doo came out, the actual, like, whatever. I don't know what I'm talking about, and I shouldn't be allowed to own a home.
No, but you will. When do you close?
The 21st, and that's, like, the actual day I have the movers coming here, too. So I also have to beat the movers out there to get the keys and all that crap. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know. But anyway, so I'm excited about that, and
But sometimes those houses in Chicago, the square footage doesn't include anything that was added on. Like, there were some that we saw that was like 1,400 square feet, and then you add in the basements like 2,800. So maybe that's what you got going. The not the normal sized refrigerator gives me a little pause there, but
I don't cook at the same time, so true. It's like, do I need one? Probably not. It's fine, no. And I still have a good overall aura of it. I still have a good feeling about the home. The last couple was there for 10 years with their two boys, so.
Oh, well, they like it, yeah.
They liked it, I must be the same as them. I'm sure I will, too. But anyway, no, that's fine. Also, last time I was on the show, I was down the Jersey Shore. Ended up leaving early because it rained the rest of the week, so I didn't even stay the whole week. Got out of there.
I need to say, Kate, you need a win. Like, you're just in a spot where you need a win.
Both my beach vacations, my only two vacations of the whole year, both got rained out, and that's it. And then I'm moving. So, yay. How about you?
Things here. I can't sell my house here, and I'm tired of it. I want to sell my house here because I might have to push back my move. Like, I might have to, I'm supposed to move on like the 6th or 7th, something like that. And I might have to push it back a couple weeks, which I do not want to do because it's like Christmas, man. Like, it's like if you were a little kid and you saw December 25th coming up, it's December 19th. You've gotten out of school. There is no more school. You're out on Christmas break. And they're like, actually, no, you're not going to get out on Christmas break until January 2nd. Like, that's kind of what I feel like is going on in here. And we got to do showing after showing after showing. And your house has to be perfect. Everything has to be perfect. Dogs have to be outside. We've been sitting in Barnes & Noble for like 6 hours on a weekend. It sucks because Gussie Boy is 11. He can't be outside that long. It's
soon
just,
enough. Soon
it's
enough.
It's a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare. I don't think anything else is going on, really, though. That's basically my life right now. It stinks. But we'll be back here next week. Either way, it's on the retreat.